The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Dave's Gone By. 90 minutes of music, talk radio, humor, and more. Brought to you by Total Theater and Performing Arts Insider. You know, we like to be eclectic on this show. We like to vary things from week to week. One of the reasons I like to do this program, I'm not bound by format. I'm not restricted by playlists. I'm not fettered by focus groups. Which is not to say Dave's Gone By never has a structure or just kind of meanders along for 90 minutes. Most of the episodes are very carefully planned, but each episode is meant to be somewhat unique. A few weeks ago, we devoted an entire evening to playing Dr. Demento-style novelty tunes. Another week, we had a live in-studio visit from the exquisite pop music band October Project. Now, the past couple of weeks, we've been mixing comedy sketches and music and really showcasing the news gone by, our version of Weekend Update or The Daily Show. So it's all about what feels right for the moment, or whatever direction I feel like taking that episode. Well, at the end of October, I was busy planning the Dr. Dave Mento show, as well as a trip to Boston and a bunch of other things, and I missed a rather sad but important piece of news, the death of one of the greatest opera tenors of the 20th century. On or around October 29th, Franco Corelli died in Milan. He had a stroke in August and had apparently never left the hospital since. He was 82 years old, and if his name is not familiar to you, like Pavarotti or Caruso or Bocelli, it's certainly not because his work went out of style or he was one of those obscure cult figures that only select opera buffs knew about. Corelli was one of the leading tenors in all international opera throughout the 50s and 60s. He played 368 performances at the Met, the first one in January 1961 in a legendary Il Trovatore with Leontine Price, also making her Met debut. Now, I played an excerpt from that production last week, and we may hear a little more later on. And Corelli sang at all the major opera houses, capping off a 25-year career with a world tour of La Boheme in 1976. And that's probably why he hasn't had the visibility of the three tenors or some of the female singers of his era, like Price, like Beverly Sills, who were American, so they had that advantage here, or they didn't retire so early. In the past couple of decades, Corelli has lived mostly in Italy. To us, it felt like seclusion, but perhaps in Europe he was a bit more visible. And in 2002, he did show up to receive an opera award and a standing ovation at the Teatro del Verme in Milan. But it's not as if he would appear on Hollywood squares. VH1 never did a Where Are They Now segment on him. In fact, it was something of a coup when Corelli did a series of radio interviews in 1990. He did them not for NPR, not for QXR, but for a college-based radio station, WKCR. And not just any show on KCR, but at the urging and coaxing and pleading of the host of one particular program on that station, Opera Fanatic. As you can tell from the title, this was not your typical middle-of-the-road, let's play some classical music radio show. This was real, inside, arcane, ardent, weird, eccentric, devotional opera worship. So you could tune in at one point in the show and hear a super specific discussion about placement of head voice and chest voice and controlling air intake in the larynx and glottis. And it was still fascinating because the explanations were quite clear and the people arguing were so passionate and learned about it. And then a half hour later, the host would be tallying votes for the greatest tenor of the century or dishing dirt about the reputed appetites, sexual and otherwise, of various opera legends. Opera Fanatic was the kind of show that illustrates the cliché, you might not be that interested or well-versed in the topic, but if the people on the show are magnetic, you're going to tune in. I mean, how many people watch Orange County Choppers on cable, and they haven't been on a Harley in their lives? Or they like a particular cooking show or redecorating program. even if their culinary skills don't stray much further than meatloaf and their home decor experience consists of moving a Barca lounger from one side of the room to the other. And that's how it was with me for Opera Fanatic. Even if I didn't like some, or opera, I liked a little bit of it, even if I hadn't been familiar with a handful of arias, I imagine that the sheer uniqueness of Opera Fanatic would have kept me tuned in every Saturday night. And that's all a credit to one man, the man who not only hosted that radio show, but founded the Bel Canto Society, devoted to expressive singing, and now a major retailer of vintage opera videos and CDs. The man I'm talking about is Stefan Zucker, and he is listed in the Guinness Book of World Records as the world's highest tenor, and he's also a world-class expert on opera. And he's joining us by phone for about an hour, I hope, of what will be amazing conversation. And if you're still not sure who this guy is or why you should stick around, trust me. I don't care if you think Puccini is a handbag and Bellini is a pasta sauce. You will want to keep listening for the next hour or so. We'll talk about Corelli and Pavarotti and the current state of opera in New York and in America. We'll play some short selections. We will be opera fanatics tonight on this 56th episode of Dave's Gone By, and we'll also do a few items in our weekly News Gone By. We've only got an hour and a half, so I've got to be frugal with the news tonight, but we'll do our best, as we do every Monday night on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com, live streaming on the net. I'm Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, writer, critic, and smooth operator. I'm the host, Stefan Zucker is the guest, and we'll both hit the high notes for all of you right after this.
La donna immobile, qual fiume al vento, muta d'accento. Sempre un amabile leggiadro viso, impianto riso e menzognero. La donna immobile, quale fiume al vento, muta d'accento. Pensier,
Franco Corelli on Dave's Gone By from Rigoletto, La Donna Immobile. I can't pronounce it properly, but I know someone who certainly can, and I'm very proud and honored that I have him as my guest. He is the host of Opera Fanatic radio program. He is the founder of the Bel Canto Society, and he is on the phone with us right now, Mr. Stefan Zucker. Stefan, welcome.
Good to be here.
It's great to hear. How are you doing, Stefan? How are things?
Oh, I'm fighting a cold, so I sound weirder still than usual.
You know what? I do have to ask about that. One of the things that attracted to me to your program years ago when I first started listening to Opera Fanatic was that your voice is so unusual, and I'm not even talking about your singing voice. Was that... Did you notice at a certain point that you didn't sound like other people?
Yes. I was teased about sounding strange as a child. I was self-conscious about my voice when I began to sing. However, I thought, well, my voice was simply not geared for city traffic, but for cruising at high altitudes or on the open road. I'm the world's highest tenor, according to the Guinness Book of World Records.
Mm-hmm.
One shouldn't reasonably expect me to sound like the man next door.
Well, but, I mean, when we hear most opera singers, when they talk, they seem to have a voice that isn't so different from the singing voice.
Well, I don't know. I think there are many counterexamples to that claim.
Oh, such as?
If you listen to Gigi's speaking voice, he sounds decidedly tenorial.
Hmm.
Or if you... I can easily multiply examples if you listen to Björling. The same is true. I did a couple of shows, for example, with the tenor Ferruccio Tagliavini.
Mm-hmm.
And it may have struck some listeners that they were listening to two speaking voices that if nothing else, not run of the mill.
Right.
In my case, of course, the height of the voice creates problems with the brain. The higher the voice, the lower the mentality. With tenors, the voice is where the brain should be, and there's a reason for that. The tenors need resonance, and the tenor voice seeks Lebensraum.
Room to stretch, yes. As the Germans used to say.
Yes.
Yeah.
And erodes the brain. So that is the plight of the high tenor. I can vouch for it.
You mean it eats brain cells? I mean,
it carves out. It creates an extra cavity.
Good God!
The voice just chisels away at the brain, so that the voice has more room to expand.
Oh gosh.
Yes.
I wasn't even going to get into the side topic, but we'll stay here for a little bit, and then we will, of course, talk about Corelli. But at a certain point, you learned that you could sing in an operatic style. I assume that was your mother's urging, because she was a singer.
Well, I grew up in that world. Corelli was a babysitter.
Yeah, that amazing. He was your babysitter a few times.
Yeah, in... June, July, August of 1951, my mother was rehearsing with him. Indeed, he stepped in when a tenor for Don Giovanni was not available.
Mm-hmm.
And he filled in at rehearsals. They had the same coach, a legendary man by the name of Giuseppe Bertelli, who had been the coach or accompanist for a number of prominent singers. He was linked to the...
Closer to the mic, please. I'm having a little trouble picking you up.
Closer to the telephone.
Telephone, sorry.
There's not a lot I can do here. So when it would come her turn to rehearse, Franco would take care of me. I don't remember any of that, but he did. He died recently.
Right.
And my mother had told me about it in some detail. She, too, is dead. He discussed this on Italian radio very amusingly back in 1996.
So was he sort of in a reclusive mode when you kind of brought him to American radio, or was he kind of out there in Europe and in Italy, and we just saw him as kind of being almost not forgotten, but certainly out of the public eye?
He had abandoned his career in 1976. In his words, he found his voice opaque. He thought that he was not singing as well as he had, and he thought he'd take a rest. Well, he found himself more comfortable without the pressure of singing. He was a very nervous performer, and found his career very, very stressful, and he decided he didn't want to perform further. Well, he was coaxed back into doing some returns in the early 80s. He did a couple of concerts in this country and a TV appearance in Sweden and some Italian appearances. But then he withdrew into his shell. Jerome Hines, the bass, scheduled some concerts, some joint recitals with the two of them in the mid-80s. But Franco got the flu and canceled. Then in 1990, was it? Yes. I finally, after years of trying, got him to appear on Opera Fanatic, my program. And indeed, you can hear some of those shows. He ended up doing 11 of them at belcantosociety.org. If you go to the website of Bel Canto Society, BelCantoSociety.org, you'll find, among others, three Guardelli shows that can be listened to if you're willing to use the Internet as a radio.
Right. Well, I hope a lot of people are, because otherwise they can't get my show unless they live on Long Island. And you know, we're streaming right now in the same way, only we're not archived on Stefan's website, several of these shows. And they're 3 or 4 hours long, these conversations, and bits of music as well, are available at any time just by clicking and going there. So I do recommend that people do that.
Again, that's at belcantosociety.org, BelCanto society.org.
Now, we might as well say, I mean, I think I know, but if people don't know what bel canto means, what does it mean?
That's a big question. It's used to refer to a period of Italian opera. For example, today people construe the term narrowly and refer to the Rossini-Bellini-Donizetti period from 1810 to 1843 as the bel canto period. Others, though, have extended the term backwards or, in some cases, forwards. It's used to refer to the style of singing of that period, or it's used to in a more general way, to refer to Italian opera or to opera in general. Literally, the term means beautiful singing, beautiful song.
Right. And speaking of beautiful song, what was it about Corelli that you find special?
He was charismatic, exciting, virile, and yet he could be very tender. He started out admiring his predecessors, a number of them, and wanting to have the best qualities of each of several tenors.
Mm-hmm.
But the qualities he thought were incompatible. So his challenge was how to achieve that. Specifically, he admired the goddess of Beniamino Gigli, the fortissimo of Mario Del Monaco, the diminuendo of Miguel Fleta, the high notes of Giacomo Lauri-Volpi, and the passion of Aureliano Pertile. Well, he at length adopted the technique used by Delmonico. He went to Delmonico's teacher, a man called Melocchi, and ended up with Delmonico's fortissimo, but no caress, no diminuendo, and difficulty with high notes. He did have passion. He emulated recordings of Pergile.
And he had somewhat of a wide vibrato early on.
Yes, yes, exactly. He didn't like his singing for that reason, because of the vibrato, and I'll come back to that in a moment. In any event, he began to experiment to modify the technique he had learned. He learned a very controversial technique that has ruined many, by Corelli's account and everyone else's, involving lowering the larynx so that at that time he sang with the larynx at the bottom of his neck. He, as a result of this technique, had a thick sound and was able to belt out some very loud notes, but this approach, he felt, limited him in expression. So he modified the technique to enable his larynx to move about. If you look at old videos or films of opera singers, you see that their larynxes don't move.
I would imagine, I didn't know anybody's larynx moved.
According to classical vocal techniques, the larynx is supposed to remain stationary. Instead, if you look at Corelli's, you see his in almost constant flux, sometimes note by note. With this approach, he was able to sing in a caressing manner. With regard to the diminuendo, the decrease in volume that he admired so in a tenor called Fleta, what happened one day was this: Franco was singing Don Carlo with the Rome opera and ran out of gas. On a certain high A flat, he did something that he thought horrendous and afterwards was terribly, terribly upset in a rage with himself. To his astonishment, people came back and said, "Oh, you know that A-flat, you made a beautiful effect there." Well, he listened to a tape, and by God, he'd made a diminuendo on a high note, something of which he had not thought himself capable. So he analyzed what he had done, until he finally perfected his diminuendo in the mid-60s. By that time, no one else was singing softly. He had felt very badly because early in his career, all the tenors were able to sing sweetly, softly, and he couldn't. By the time he was able to do that, the others weren't. And it was out of fashion. But he continued to do it nonetheless. On the subject of vibrato, singers in Italy and France and Slavic countries for many years since the 1810s had sung with omnipresent, conspicuous, fast vibratos. Franco started out that way, but by that point, that sort of vibrato was falling out of fashion, and he decided to eliminate it, which at length he did, so that by the late 50s it was seldom in evidence by 1959 or 60.
And that was also from moving the larynx, or did he find that was a different thing he did?
He was able to deal with that, he said, by increasing breath support. So he fiddled around with the method and at length came to support his voice by constricting muscles slightly by pulling in muscles low in the abdomen, in the pubic and pelvic region. So,
if we want to, we've been talking a lot about Cardinal Lee. I think it's time for us to hear a bit of what you're talking about. Should we do the diminuendo, or should we go spinto?
Well, maybe we should listen to him in a caressing vein with the diminuendo.
That sounds like Iluchivan?
Yeah. I sent Dave a recording put out by my company, Bel Canto Society, of a live performance Cordelli gave in Parma in 1967. That performance, he used his by then celebrated diminuendo and sang with a great deal of introspection and caress, particularly in the opening measures of the aria. If Guardelli were alive, he would say, don't stop at the end of the aria, but play a little bit beyond and listen to what happens right after the track with the aria. Do you have the track at hand?
Sorry, Stefan, we were just setting up the CD there to make sure that we're getting it ready right now.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard the last. He, at Franco Wood's request, indeed once when I played this aria during a theater evening that we gave, he asked me to do this and was very upset when the engineer in charge failed to. He would request that we don't stop at the end of the aria, and there is a track break there, but continue beyond the end of the aria for reasons that will become apparent.
Right. I don't know if we'll be able to play that much past the end of the aria, but I think people will see what he meant. And just want to remind folks that we're listening to Stefan Zucker on Dave's Gone By, and on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com. And now we're going to listen to Franco Cordelli with, I think, the most exquisite version of Eluchavan La Stella basically ever done. Starts on track 8, Joe, and just play it right through. Franco Corelli, that's the applause following his extraordinary Luce van la Stella from Tosca. And that goes on, by the way. It's on the CD. It goes on for about 2.5 minutes, and they almost don't even let the opera go on. They keep saying bis, bis, which means again, again, encore, encore. And you almost think every other minute they're going to just get them out there and do the aria again, but then they go on with the opera.
Yes, yes.
So that is quite an extraordinary moment.
Well, there's a CD with you, I hope, of Corelli in La Gioconda, Ponchielli's La Gioconda, again a recording put out by Bel Canto Society, of which I'm president, that demonstrates his rage. Much of the repertoire he sang didn't give him the opportunity to get really angry. That was something he did a great deal off stage, however. But
Stefan, just which CD and which track? So Joe can cue
well,
it up.
Well, let's see. Try disc 3.
Mm-hmm.
3 short tracks, 29, 30, and 31. Together totaling just over 3 minutes.
Super. So you were saying about the anger.
Yes, but this part gave him the opportunity to become angry on stage, and you can hear that to good effect here. He sings Enzo. Enzo believes that La Gioconda has abducted the body of his girlfriend. He wants to kill La Gioconda. His girlfriend does wake up just at that moment. This is opera. She had been drugged so that she would appear dead, so that her husband would be satisfied that in fact she had taken poison. In any event, in this scene, Corelli works up a bit of a rage.
Excellent. Okay, so let us hear. And I'm sorry, what is the actual title of the piece?
Part of it is called O Furibonda Iena.
O Furibonda Iena. And this is from La Gioconda.
Yeah.
Oh,
Okay, we've been listening to selections from La Gioconda with Franco Corelli, of course, singing. And Stefan?
Yes, he had his larynx lowered to the maximum from most of that.
And that's just a physical thing that he does on stage, that he can physically control.
Yes. Try doing it when you speak. You'll find it that you can't. It's something that one can achieve only through great practice. Many singers, myself among them, don't like the method for all kinds of reasons and don't attempt to manipulate the position of the larynx. He did. He created what he himself termed a laryngomania here in New York among aspiring singers, and deplored the results with singers with their larynxes bumping their belly buttons. What happened, he felt, was that the method was so exaggerated by most who attempted to copy him that voices sounded aged prematurely.
Well, do you think cost him some years off his career by doing that?
That's very controversial. I'm not sure. I certainly contemplated that idea. Would he have sung longer had he used another method? Possibly. There's a good deal of speculation among Corelliani about what caused some changes in his singing that he himself disliked in the beginning in the late 60s and going into the 70s and leading ultimately to his premature retirement, according to his adherents. I'm not sure whether to ascribe some of the things that happened to him to the laryngeal method or to a number of other things that were happening at the time.
Yeah.
He, for example, went to a health spa where they told him, don't sing while you're taking this inhalation. He was in wonderful voice and sang. He claimed that caused, in his words, one of his vocal cords to soften.
Yeah.
And that one chord, as a result, ended up doing the work of two. But then he did a lot of wonderful singing in the wake of that. His wife always said, oh, don't listen to him when he tells you about that. That's just his hypochondria.
I want to talk a bit more about Corelli and about opera in general and about opera phonetic with you. I do need to take a couple of commercials here, but we will be right back with Franco Corelli and, of course, Stefan Zucker on Dave's Gone By. Be right back with you. Performing Arts Insider, three words that represent a whole world of entertainment found on Broadway, off-Broadway, cabaret. Hundreds of productions to see and enjoy. But how can you keep them all straight? Performing Arts Insider, the guide to everything that's happening on the stages of New York. For six decades, Performing Arts Insider has been a bible of the industry. Each issue lists hundreds of shows, who wrote them, what they're about, who's in the cast, the designers, the producers, box office info, parental guides, reviews of what's good, what's bad, and why. Plus, listings for opera, dance, and awards, too. As the chief editor of Backstage put it, Performing Arts Insider puts all the facts at your fingertips. To subscribe or get a sample issue, call 516-295-1511 or go to www.totaltheater.com and click on Performing Arts Insider.
Did you know Dave Lefkowitz of Dave's Gone By is not just a radio personality? He's also a playwright. And his book, Marriage Babies and the End of the World, is filled with the same humor he brings to his show every week. funny, sad, and true. At only $20 hardcover, $12 trade paperback, Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World makes a great gift. So get your copy today. Call 516-295-1511. That's 516-295-1511. Or email davesgoneby@aol.com.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. I'm your host, Dave Lefkowitz, and talking very happily and proudly to Stefan Zucker, the host of Opera Fanatic radio program, which you can hear on his website, belcantosociety.org. It's also a place where you can order videos and CDs of archival opera recordings of the greats that are really not available anywhere else. If you want to tell us a little bit more about that, please do.
Well, one thing led to another in my life. I'm a tenor who developed sinusitis. I always had it, really. It slowly got worse across the years. I'd always had allergies, to the point that I lost my nerve as a performer, which really is what happened in part to Franco. And he's the first to say that that was a main consideration for him in retiring. What happened to both of us, for very different reasons, was that we didn't know if we could deliver the goods on as performers on this or that occasion. At issue for me was that I would end up singing the way I'm speaking today. I would end up sometimes hoarse, sometimes nasal, very prone to head colds. And so I thought, well, I can't count on having my voice on that occasion. I'm the thunderstorm Caruso. During a rainstorm or immediately afterwards, I've got my voice. Then, when the pollutants come back, I lose it again, which is what happened. I had my voice this morning, for example. And I've got a little cold, and that contributes to it. Anyway, the bottom line is that I found my way into the publishing magazine, Opera Fanatic, and putting out videos and CDs of performances of opera's greats, Corelli among them. We have a catalog of more than 400 titles. My specialties, well, pitching records. According to me, most records and tapes are off-pitch because of mechanical flaws. Records and tapes made, say, more than 30 years ago, before the invention of a particular kind of motor, so-called hysteresis synchronous motor, that was reasonably speed accurate. So that what I do is meticulously pitch older material against tone generators. I've written a number of articles, published a number of articles about the tuning pitch, A equals 440, in use for this in this country for more than 100 years, was not used on the European continent until quite recently. Much higher tuning pitches having been the rule. Tuning pitches a quarter step or more higher than 440. Many of Corelli's recordings, for example, and performances were at A equals 448, a little bit more than a quarter step beyond A equals 440. Well, Anglo-Saxon record producers regiment these recordings and attempt to pitch them all at 440. I do research and try to determine the tuning pitch in use at the opera house at that time, and pitch accordingly and consistently, although I make allowances for the sharpening of pitch that occurs during performances because players begin to play sharp for a number of reasons, instruments heating up among them. But so that's one thing that I'm obsessed with, and the recordings are adjusted accordingly. Another thing is that I loathe digital sound. For many years I refused to put out CDs because I couldn't stand working with digital sound on account of two things.
Mm-hmm.
The hardness, harshness, glare that traditional digital technology introduces, and the fact that digital sound renders soft overtones poorly, so that you lose what I term bloom from a voice. You also lose the sound of a voice decaying into space, fading out into space. Digital just chops things like that off ordinarily. Well, eventually a man in Canada by the name of Meitner, according to me, rescued digital sound by coming out with analog-to-digital converters that did not do these things. And as a result, we're able to, at Bel Canto Society, we're able to preserve the sound of the analog tapes and preserve the sound of 78s and other old sources when we do our analog-to-digital transfers.
If I can break here and go to ask a question about old versus new. A lot of, I guess it's with almost every discipline, whether it be opera or theater or dance or books, there's always the generation that says, oh, in the old days things were so much better, the singers were so much more exciting, they had so much more skill and talent, the opera directors had so much more to say. Is it true, or is that just one generation always saying that things were better in the old days? I mean, how would you compare the way things are? I guess I would have to stay sort of in America, but the state of opera today as it was in the 40s and 50s, which I guess in some, or the 60s, which may have been something of a golden age here.
Let me defer grappling with that question for just a moment.
Sure.
Back in the 1830s, people said we're at the peak, but look, our singers are getting older, and look who's coming after them. The younger singers don't measure up. And so people knew that in 10 years or so, when the older stars retired, that they would be replaced by singers less good. There were a lot of reasons for that. The older stars had been trained by castratos who had developed certain methods during the Napoleonic, certain vocal techniques. During the Napoleonic period, castration was suppressed so that the old teachers and their methods fell by the wayside. There were a number of reasons why that happened, but the absence of castratos and their teachings was perhaps paramount. Also, certain trends in composition made virtuosity less important. The singers had no incentive to develop big techniques. In any event, I would maintain that technically singing has been in decline since the 1830s. With regard to the 40s and 50s, the level of singing in this country was terribly uneven. On the one hand, yes, there were great stars. On the other hand, the average performance was a pretty bland affair, and much of the singing was incompetent in the sense that the American singers in those days, for example, had very poor Italian, typically, and were outsiders to Italian tradition even more than is the case today. So that on the one hand, American performances have become, well, more professional. On the other hand, you don't get the big thrilling stars now that who flourished back then.
Speaking of big thrilling stars, we'll move away from Corelli for just a moment, because as long as I've got you on the phone, I might as well ask about really the most famous, the Caruso of our day, who's still kind of going semi-strong, would be Pavarotti. and have to ask you your basic opinion of him and his career.
On the one hand, I've often lambasted him for being superficial emotionally and interpretively. On the other hand, I've usually enjoyed myself thoroughly when I've gone to hear him. He communicates great joy in singing sometimes, despite all the effort he puts into his singing. He had great brilliance of tone. Squillo, S-Q-U-I-L-L-O, as the Italians call it, squillo, ring or ping, which in and of itself I find exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to put across a piece, provided it didn't require the expression of grief, heartbreak, suffering of the soul.
You didn't think he had that, what's the word you have for it that you put out there in your magazine of anguish that...
You may be thinking of the term fuoco sacro, or sacred fire. I wouldn't say that he really had that. Let me explain. What makes opera interpretations, singing interpretations, interesting? What is expressive singing? There are several aspects. Musical expression in the form of rubato, taking time from one note and giving it to another. Musical expression that reveals phrase shape. In much music, you get maybe one chord change in a phrase, and the vocal line at that point has a dissonance. According to me, the singer should build toward that dissonance with a crescendo. It's a small crescendo. This can be a subtle thing, but still there should be, if you will, forward motion toward that dissonance, and then he should taper away from it. One seldom gets that. So if you think, say, Happy Birthday, with the birthday girl being April, you get Dear April rather than Dear April, because the singers don't bring out the dissonance that is on ape. Instead, they land on the consonants that follows it. So musical expression is one aspect of expressive singing, according to me.
Mm-hmm.
Central to musical expression is
Sorry about that. That's just the doorbell here. Please go on.
Yep. It is revealing the shape of the melody and responding to harmonic events such as the portatura in Happy Birthday. Beyond that, there is vocal acting, coloring the voice to express words and to express emotions. And then something that Rossini called il cantar che nell'anima si sente, singing felt in the soul singing, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Although not in the way 1960s people would consider it soul singing, of course.
Later it came to be called fuoco sacro, the sacred fire. And it's something rarely experienced, but once one has experienced it, one becomes an opera junkie. Until that point, one is apt to remain indifferent to opera, if not downright hostile to it. What does one need all that for? Once, however, it has gripped one, perhaps made one weep, one is in its thrall and returns to performance after performance and listens to recording after recording just in case lightning strikes again.
Well, Stefan, I have time for one more question before we end the segment, because, of course, I have a whole list of questions that I wish I could ask, and we will have to table them, I hope, for next time. Please say yes that it will be a next time, because this is wonderful.
With delight.
Great.
I think you're a great interviewer, by the way.
Stefan, thank you. But my question is, since you are talking about that catharsis, that emotion, that click that you get when opera just has to be part of your life and changes you from not even caring about it to being an opera fanatic, junkie, what was that moment for you?
My mother had four Cossacks, though, and so I grew up with it. And I was always an opera fanatic, but I noticed with listeners to opera fanatic that once they were moved in this manner, once they were gripped by a sizzling performance, they craved more.
Well, I crave more of talking to you, and I hope and I plan to do that in the very near future. I want to remind everybody to check Stefan's website, belcantosociety.org, that's B-E-L, one L, cantosociety.org. It's where, again, you can buy CDs and videos of classic and archival opera performances. You can also hear more of Stefan, his archived shows from his years on KCR. And are you doing a couple of new ones?
Yeah, there's a recent interview with the tenor Carlo Bergonzi the site.
Wow. So, yes, there's a lot of major stuff. Please, folks, go check it out. And we're going to go out with a little more Corelli doing Cielo e Mar on this edition, this opera fanatical edition of Dave's Gone By. I just want to thank Stefan once more. Thank you so much for a wonderful interview.
Well, thank you so much for asking searching questions.
You're very welcome. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com. It's time for the News Gone By, a look at world and local events of the past week from a Puccini-weenie perspective. The top story? Well, of course, it's the capture of Saddam Hussein, public enemy number two on the U.S. hit parade. Hats off to the American military and to the Bush administration. They got him. I don't know how, but they found the needle in the sand stack. And it's pretty amazing. And they took him alive. Hussein was armed with a pistol, but he put up no resistance. This from the man who urged his armies to fight to the death. He was disoriented, rumpled, disheveled, and even under intense questioning, denied everything. In fact, if you blinked, you could have sworn he was John Kerry at the last presidential debate. No, but the big political news on these shores was that former Vice President Al Gore surprised the Democratic Party last week. He threw his support behind presidential candidate Howard Dean rather than Joseph Lieberman. This got Lieberman so mad, he almost, very nearly, just about, actually came this close to saying something interesting. Meanwhile, the aforementioned John Kerry tried to energize his campaign by saying the F word, for which he immediately took flack. No, not that F word. He said, quote, George Bush really effed up in Iraq, which got all the right-wingers and scum-dementalists up in arms, not over the criticism of Bush's policies, which are arguable, but over how dare John Kerry use naughty language when campaigning, blah, blah, blah. As if Harry Truman, LBJ, Bill Clinton, Richard Nixon, as if they had the cleanest vocabularies since Jane Austen. For his part, over the years, George Bush has used his share of four-letter words. Of course, he mispronounces them, but still. Well, those who are leery about Islam need look no further than the Palestinian factions who met in Egypt last week. Hamas, Jihad, and Fatah, the Larry, Moe, and Curly of the Middle East, making violence funny for the rest of us. These groups spent 3 days at a conference trying to agree on a ceasefire deal. They were split over whether to offer Israel a limited truce or a full ceasefire. Now let's be clear here. This is not a peace treaty. This isn't hashing out a land deal over Jerusalem. This isn't negotiating the governance of a future Palestinian state. No. This is just getting a bunch of warlords together and asking them to stop doing terrorism, and they're arguing about this. They can't figure out how to stop killing. The concept of not slaughtering people is like a math problem they can't figure out. How to stop minusing. And I wonder, what is there to debate about? Let's see. If we stop blowing up bombs in Israel, can we still blow them up around Israel? Can we kill on the West Bank if we leave Jerusalem alone? What about East Jerusalem, but not West Jerusalem? And can we still use women, or only 14-year-old boys? These so-called freedom fighters can't even agree whether to stop attacks on civilians. So this is what we're dealing with. This is what Israel is dealing with. Oh, wait, this just in. The Arab leaders did come to an agreement, a consensus, on one crucial issue. 20-size lattes, not grande. Well, some Arabs do work together more cooperatively. For example, the Arab community in Irvine, California, thought it would be a nice idea to create a Muslim football league, get the youth together in a healthy athletic activity, which was all well and good, until the kids started choosing names for the teams. Among the names chosen were Soldiers of Allah, Mujahideen, which means Holy Warrior, and my favorite, Intifada, which technically means uprising, but really means kill Jews. Surprise, surprise, the Jewish community in Irvine is up in arms over these names. One rabbi told the Associated Press, quote, "Something like this supports those who have suspicions about the real intent of Islam." On the other side, one of the team captains told AP, quote, "A lot of the kids are from Palestinian origin, in solidarity with people in the uprising. It's about human rights and basic freedoms," unquote. But another Arab organizer had asked the teams to change the names. This is true. And he said, quote, "It bothers me a little bit, but they were just trying to be cool," unquote. Well, I don't know. Kids do try to pick rough and tough names for sports teams. So do adults. Pirates, Redskins, that's tasteful, Warriors. And I guess we should be grateful the Arab teams didn't go with their original ideas for names, the Falling Towers, the Cafe Bombers, and the Oil Hikes. Here's a story from the syndicated Weird But True column, published locally in the New York Post. 16-year-old Daniel Robbins of Great Falls, Montana, ran over 40-year-old Patty Emanuel with his SUV. Cops had no problem charging him with deliberate murder, since Robbins told police that he purposely ran the woman down so he could have sex with her corpse. The victim survived and said she couldn't understand such a senseless act. After all, any man can have sex with a motionless female carcass. All he has to do is get married. I'm kidding. I love you, honey. Please don't change the locks. In alcoholical news from Weird But True, Swedish police are warning people to beware of drunken elks. A woman was attacked by one in the city of Karlshamn. Apparently, the elk became intoxicated after munching on the last of the summer berries. The juice ferments and literally becomes an alcoholic beverage. Some of the elk get really calm and mellow, but others get quite aggressive, and there is nothing worse than angry, drunken elks. Well, except angry, drunken Shriners. Speaking of the fermented grape, in the small town of Belgrade, Minnesota, charges of driving while intoxicated have been dropped against resident Brad Leeser. Oh, he was guilty, but the reason here is that Belgrade has only 750 people in it, and they can't afford the legal fees to prosecute. Said the police chief, quote, "A few thousand dollars for one case, that's time we can have an officer handling other cases." In related news, Michael Jackson has decided to move his Neverland Ranch to the small town of Belgrade, Minnesota. Also in youth-related news, a teenager in New Jersey was providing a urine sample for a drug test when the probation officer ordered him to remove his pants. No, it's not what you think. The officer suspected foul play. Turned out, the boy was carrying several bags of urine being kept warm by a penis-shaped heating unit. The boy said he wasn't upset about being caught, but you could tell he was pissed off. Whoa, whoa, whatever could that be? That ringing, that incessant non-holiday jingling. Could it be? Oh my God, it is! It's the comedy bell, signaling the Dave's Gone By bad pun of the week. Every week we make a play on words so bladderific, all we can do is tinkle the comedy bell. And if you want to hear that sound in connection with your business, not your personal business, I mean your establishment, your career, your product, event, or service, and put your money where your money is and advertise on Dave's Gone By. The rates are cheap. The method is memorable. The results remarkable. If you think I'm kidding, what's the name of that Indian restaurant in Rockville Center? Did you say the Tandoor Grill? And if I ask, why should you leave off the last I? Did you say, because it's Indialicious? Now, if you listen to this show regularly, you answered those questions, and maybe you even went to the Tandoor Grill and had a delicious meal, like I did, or you ordered a copy of Performing Arts Insider magazine, and now you use it to plan your theater going over the holidays. I don't steer my listeners wrong. Yes, I want advertisers, I need sponsors, and I'm happy to pitch a variety of products and services. But listeners trust me, because they know if an advertiser chooses this show, they're not selling the usual crap to an undiscriminating audience. We're selling better crap to you! And if you have good crap to sell, special crap, this is the place. Advertising on Dave's Gone By works on three principles: repetition, humor, and repetition. And it helps us reach thousands of listeners every week with my message and yours. So advertise on this program by sponsoring the Dave's Gone By bad pun of the week, or a different segment if you prefer. Call 516-295-1511 to find out how. 516-295-1511. Between the internet and our local audience, you won't find a cheaper or better way to reach so many good people. 516-295-1511, or email davesgoneby@aol.com. davesgoneby, no apostrophe, @AOL.com, to sponsor the Dave's Gone By bad pun of the week. Don't be good, be ponderful. On to science news on the News Gone By. The Denver Zoo is giving its four orangutans aromatherapy treatment. Yes, oil extracts from plants are being used to treat everything from allergies to depression. One 20-year-old ape named Mias gets chamomile on his right ear, basil and angelica on his nose, and fennel, eucalyptus, and frankincense on his forehead. The other monkeys around him are a little jealous, but they told reporters, quote, "Okay, so Mias smells like Bed Bath & Beyond, but hey, we're not even trying, and our farts smell like bananas." Also on the diet front, if you thought illusionist David Blaine was special for going 44 days without food or water, that's nothing compared to Indian guru Prahlad Jani. He claims to have lived his entire life without eating or drinking anything at all. The 76-year-old mystic recently spent 10 days in the hospital, and nobody could disprove his claim. Closed-circuit cameras watched his every move. He didn't eat, he didn't drink, and he never went to the bathroom. The neurologist who ran tests on Johnny told the Times of London that the guru creates urine, but it's reabsorbed into his bladder wall. This is a one-of-a-kind case, he said, without scientific explanation. Johnny says his talent for fasting began when he was 8 years old and visited by a goddess. Cynics say a more likely explanation is that he once passed by the kitchen of a Taco Bell. No, but Johnny's case is being taken seriously outside India. In fact, Republican lawmakers have asked him to testify at a panel on welfare reform. After all, what is the justification for food stamps when it's obvious the poor are just too darn lazy to stop eating? Speaking of David Blaine, you knew after he did that glass box stunt, copycats were sure to follow. Well, here's one copycat who went right to the dogs. Max Sartore, an animal rights activist living in Germany, accused the Greek government of cruelty towards stray animals. He says that in preparing for the next Olympics, taking place in Athens, officials there are sterilizing or euthanizing the stray dog population. To protest this, Sartori dressed up in a dog costume and tied himself to a crucifix outside the Greek embassy in Berlin. Now, the crucifix was 12 feet high, with a banner draped across it reading, "No blood for the Olympics." Sartori stayed on the cross for 72 hours, taking off 5 hours a day for sleep. He would have stayed up longer, but he was betrayed by a golden retriever who turned Sartori into the authorities for 30 pieces of Alpo. And that's the news gone by for December 15th, 2003. Please send your comments, opinions, and penis-shaped heating units to Dave's Gone By, P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062. Dave's Gone By, P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062. If you like the show, tell us. If you love the show, tell us. If you hate the show, tell us. Just don't tell anyone else. Send us a letter or an email, davesgoneby@aol.com. You are part of this show. I can't see you, but I know you're there. I can hear you laughing. I can hear you breathing. I can hear you... Oh, man, what, did you have chili for lunch? Dave's Gone By at AOL.com. Send me cards, send me letters, but please, no aromatic oils. I'm frank and sensitive. Oh, my, what an amazing show it has been, and we still have about 10 minutes left. I first of all want to thank Stefan Zucker, host of Opera Fanatic, publisher of Opera Fanatic magazine and founder of the Bel Canto Society. Do check out belcantosociety.org. The selections from Tosca and the La Gioconda I played earlier were both out of the Bel Canto label, so that gives you some idea of the quality of the selections. It's not modern digital audio. You could hear that. It doesn't sound like today's Z100 hit. But it's a miracle these performances were preserved at all. And once you get past the age of the source material, which takes about 2 minutes, you get right into the music. BelCantoSociety.org. Thank you again, Stefan, for a fabulous hour. And listen to Stefan's weekly show, which continues on streaming audio at that website. Several shows are archived, so you can listen whenever you want or repeatedly. BelCantoSociety.org. And hey, he is not the only one with a website. Check out mine, HTTP, two little dots, two forward slashes, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By. We change the site every week, and it has pictures, song lyrics, cute links, information on how to order cassettes of past programs, and a copy of my book. Still, not too late for Christmas if you get your money in now. Or Hanukkah with a mail system, all right, you're pushing it the first night. But if you order a gift now, you should make it by the fifth latke. hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By. If you forget the URL, just Google search Dave's Gone By, and we're right up top. And I don't know if we can top this week's show next week. That may be too tall an order, but I think we can match it, because I'll have another special guest. 6 special guests, in fact, here in the studio. Joy Rose, Kyle Ann Burt, Donna Kelly, Susan Graham, Gillian Crane, and Angela Babin. Yes, ladies. Housewives, in fact, and proud of it. They are the Housewives on Prozac, a group that kind of mirrors this show in that they mix satire and silly songs with serious material, all in a very knowing what-the-hell attitude. They've got a live CD out, and we'll play selections from that next week. They might also do an acoustic number or two for us in the studio. They're currently pushing a single, a novelty number, written and produced this year, but many months before that news item we read last week, the one about the woman who went to the mall the day after Thanksgiving, and there were so many people in such a stampede, she was trampled on and briefly collapsed on top of a DVD player. Now, subsequent information has emerged that this woman has had other incidents and may have exaggerated her ordeal. But the malls do get a little crazy this time of year. Well, they have to, or else they're out of business next year. And shoppers had better beware, or else they might wind up like the lady of this tune, written by lead vocalist Joy Rose. Yes, finishing up Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com. Before that little commercial, we heard Housewives on Prozac, I Broke My Arm, Christmas Shopping at the Mall. I love that, ow, 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 ow. And we're going to hear more songs by that sextet and from them directly as they visit this program live next week, December 22nd. It's our holiday show, so to speak, so we'll have some other treats for you as well. Maybe a few carols of my own, so be afraid, be very afraid. But I'm not afraid, I'm thankful. Thankful to a bunch of people, including, of course, engineer Joe Salzone, back at 100%, glad he's feeling better. Listen to his show, all his shows, Your World with Joe Salzone, Sunday nights at 6, Conservative Politics from an Open-Minded Perspective, Joe Salzone. He's also on Sunday nights at 11 with a more loose and free-form program, and catch his cable TV show, 1 o'clock Sunday afternoons, Channel 20 on Long Island Cable, and he's also going to be here Christmas Eve with something like a 4-hour show on the 24th. 5-hour show, he shouts to me. It's music, it's talk, it's what, Saddam Hussein, what is it?
Yeah, we're going to cover all the politics of the world. No, it's going to be a very traditional kind of Christmassy show.
It's going to be the radio version of the Yule log, basically.
Yes.
And
without the flaming.
Thank you. But yeah, I see the log right there. Channel 20, I don't know what that means. And of course, Joe is here Monday nights at 6, opening the evening's programming for a half hour before I go on. Dave's Gone By, starting up at 6:30. A couple of other thank yous. Bonnie D. Graham, host of Long Island's Dating, Single Her Out, Friday nights at 6. And thank you to the Tandoor Grill, 222 Sunrise Highway in Rockville Center, across from the Long Island Railroad on the opposite side of Sunrise Highway. See their menu at tandoorgrill.com. Not tandoori, tandoor. Leave off the last I for Indialicious. Thank you once more to Stefan Zucker of the Bel Canto Society. And thank you to my wife, Joyce, who is sweeter than the most expressive song. Thank you also, beloved listeners. Thank you so much for listening. We're back next week with our 57th show. It's called Housewives on Prozac on Dave. I like that title. Until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night. Happy Hanukkah. And gone by.
I will go on my way and jump the hedges first.